The first century Roman essayist and philosopher Plutarch is perhaps most famous today for his stylized biographies of Greek and Roman statesmen, whom he paired together so that readers could more easily discern the virtues and vices of a military general, say, or a great orator, by comparing two of a kind. In Plutarch's parallel lives, Alexander, who conquered the Mediterranean world, is compared to Caesar, who in his day did much the same. Alcibiades and Coriolanus are paired together so that we can see how spiritedness and martial virtue, when not tempered by political judgment, can wreak havoc on the very polities that a general whose soul is rightly ordered will sacrifice himself in order to protect. Plutarch's lives are moral portraits, and explicitly so. Their task is the moral formation of the reader, civic education, and the inculcation of virtue. They inspired Shakespeare's portraits of Coriolanus and Caesar, and Brutus and Cassius and Casca. Jean-Jacques Rousseau draws inspiration from Plutarch in his admiration of Sparta and in the education of Émile. The American essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson once called Plutarch's parallel lives a Bible for heroes. But now we could ask, what about the actual Bible? The regimes of European antiquity furnish for our example no shortage of outstanding men. But who's prepared to look into the Hebrew Bible and the Jewish tradition that it inaugurates to draw portraits of excellence in Jewish leadership? Welcome to the Tikva Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Silver. My guest this week has taken on precisely this task and has just published a new book, Providence and Power, 10 Portraits in Jewish Statesmanship. The rabbi of Congregation Sherith Israel in New York, the director of the Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University, the host of the podcast Bible 365, and also of the podcast Jerusalem 365, Meir Soloveitchik. If you enjoy this conversation, you can subscribe to the Tikva podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I hope you'll leave us a 5-star review so we can grow this community of ideas. I welcome your feedback on this or any of our other podcast episodes at podcast@tikvafund.org. And of course, if you want to learn more about our work at Tikva, you can visit our website, tikvafund.org, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Here now is my conversation with Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, welcome back to the Tikva podcast.
Thank you so much, John. It's wonderful to be speaking with you.
Okay, so the book profiles 10 portraits in Jewish statesmanship. We'll talk about many of them in the course of our conversation, but maybe you could just begin by explaining why you decided to include the people that you decided and some of the obvious people you left out, and what were the principles of selection?
The theme of the book is given to us by the title, which is Providence and Power. And at the heart of the book is the thesis that the biblical ideal of statesmanship is reflected in a balance between these two themes. Great statesmen are independent actors, and yet for the Bible, they have to be more than that. They have to be constantly aware that they are part of a larger providential plan in the unfolding of God's chosen people. And so there's a dialectic. They are, to paraphrase Milton Himmelfarb, not just actors, but acted upon. The great personification of this dialectic is David. If you read the Psalms, David is describing his own life, but also the feeling that God is behind everything that has happened to him. And so the people in this book are either leaders that embodied excellence in this regard, or conversely, leaders whose Jewish stories are so seemingly unlikely that they are themselves the ultimate reflection of providence in Jewish history. So these are either statesmen for whom Judaism and the Jewish worldview is central to their own understanding of themselves as statesmen. And that would be true of David and Esther, and Menachem Begin, and Menashe ben Israel, and Abravanel, or they are statesmen who start their story with very little sense of their Jewishness, for example, Louis Brandeis, but whose Jewish story is so unlikely and so striking that it is the ultimate indication, at least from my understanding, of the role of providence in Jewish history.
Okay, so maybe we could just begin with David. Readers of great Western literature and the classics of Greek antiquity know that Homer, for example, uses these telling epithets connected to all of his characters that are like the tagline that in sum tells the essence of the person. Odysseus is described as having many wiles, Odysseus of the fleet foot, and so on. In our biblical tradition, we have something similar. We know Abraham as Avraham Avinu, as our father. And we know Moses as Moshe Rabbeinu, as our great teacher. And we always think of David as David HaMelech, David the king. He is in some ways, for you and for our tradition, the embodiment of kingship. And he's a good template for us to begin to understand the complexities of Jewish power.
Yes, David is the ultimate Jewish embodiment and biblical embodiment of the king, precisely because he takes the ancient notion of kingship and turns it on its head. Precisely in an age when kings are worshipped as divine or semi-divine beings, he takes his greatest moments and utilizes them to turn all glory to God. The most famous moment in his early career when he faces Goliath begins in his reciting his resume to Shaul, to Saul, describing the lion and the bear that he has killed, and then in his trying out for the role of fighting Goliath. And it sounds like he's describing his own strength, but he immediately concludes by saying, "The God who has saved me from the lion and from the bear, he will save me from this Philistine." David is saying to Saul, in other words, "I will play a role in God's salvation of his chosen people." And of course, that's reflected in David's greatest dream, the dream denied, which was to crown the seemingly unconquerable city that he had conquered with a temple that would give glory to God, so that the city that was known as David's city, Ir David, would ultimately be known as, first and foremost, the city of God. It's interesting you mention a Homer, John, because the uniqueness of David can be found in a contrast between his writings and all other classical writings. And this is a point made by Thomas Cahill, who wrote The Gifts of the Jews. It's even more interesting when seen through non-Jewish eyes, I think. What he writes is that David's Psalms are the first time in classical writing where we actually see the word I to mean the interiority of the human being. In other words, we're not given in Shakespearean fashion the interiority of Achilles, his struggles and his religious feelings. And that's not what we're given. Unlike in the Bible, Lahavdil, we're given all sorts of details about the battles by Homer, but David gives us his struggles, his fears, or as Cahill puts it, David is the confirmation that thousands of years ago, people laughed, I'm paraphrasing, something like laughed, rejoiced, and wept just as we do today. And that's true, but I would add to that, that what's amazing about David is not just that, but that God is part of every aspect of those struggles. David is talking to God and is feeling the intimacy of the Almighty when he's crying, when he's laughing, when he's rejoicing, when he's angry, when he's hating, when he's loving. And placing that intimacy with God is at the heart of David's statesmanship, which is what sets him apart as a king. And it's also, I would add, why so many people today have difficulty truly understanding David, because David's intimate faith feels so foreign to so many today.
Just thinking about this from the perspective of politics, and again, I think it's useful to continue to contrast the models of political statesmanship that you offer here with the ones that are more familiar to students of political thought. What you have in this biblical template is somebody who, just as much as they're an independent power, autonomous, acting upon the world, there's also a sense of, you know, to use this spatial metaphor, they're also consciously restricting themselves, diminishing themselves in important respects. There's this essential quality of humility, and that humility takes the form of seeing the providential force of God's chosen relationship with his people acting through history. And you sort of have to get out of the way.
Yeah, it's an aspect of biblical statesmanship, and I try to show, of Jewish statesmanship, that is not really found in the great examples of European statesmanship. I mentioned in the book that when I did an interview of my friend Andrew Roberts, the great British historian, when he published his magisterial biography of Churchill, Churchill is a hero of mine, but no one would ever say he was humble. And I asked Andrew, could he name a great European statesman that reflected the virtue of humility? And he didn't have an example. But it is worth mentioning, and this is, I think, linked to the Hebraic roots of America, that we do have examples of that in the story of the United States, and especially with the example of Lincoln. There's an amazing letter that Lincoln wrote about the Emancipation Proclamation, all the more striking because the Emancipation Proclamation is the ultimate example of bold and independent statesmanship. And Lincoln is writing this letter defending the choice that he made to issue this proclamation.
There's no more clear example of the expression of independent executive power than this.
Exactly. And yet he concludes the letter by saying something like, that he wants to add that in making this decision, I feel somehow, he writes, that I have not engineered these events, but that the events have engineered it through me. And part of the grandeur of the story of Lincoln and what makes it so moving is that precisely at the period of American history where he is taking executive action, he is also constantly meditating on how he is part of some larger American story of which God is ultimately the true director. That's the one parallel in American history. There is something close to that with Washington when he reflects awe at the unlikely nature of the American Revolution. And we don't find real parallels to that in, say, Palmerston or Churchill. I do have a chapter on Disraeli, but humility is not the virtue I emphasize in my chapter on Disraeli. The book is about Jewish statesmanship. It's not about American statesmanship in general, but it is worth noting that in the greatest examples of American leadership, we do find parallels to what we're describing here.
And again, when I think about the great statesmen that come down, for example, in the writings of Plutarch, drawing examples from Greek antiquity and Roman antiquity, and when I think about the great statesmen that come to us in European history, I think of basically two activities that statesmen are responsible for. The arena of their achievement come, number one, in the arena of legislation, of lawgiving, of founding. That's maybe the paradigmatic highest expression of statesmanship is founding a new regime and creating for it a way of life, and that's done through laws. And number two, the second arena is military leadership. Napoleon, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, okay, people who conquer vast territories. So if I say that the European tradition of statesmanship at its best, with its roots extending back to Greece and Rome, are found in the arenas of legislation and military leadership, what is the activity of Jewish statesmanship?
It's such an interesting question. And by the way, separately, but perhaps worth speaking about, is the lacunae that inspired this book, which is, why don't we have a Plutarch's lives in Jewish literature? Why isn't there more writing about Jewish leadership, statesmanship, political excellence? That's part of what inspired this book, is the fact that there really isn't a parallel to Plutarch's lives in Jewish literature. But ultimately, what sets Jewish statesmen apart, Jewish leaders apart in general, is that they, at very specific moments, somehow understand that they are at a turning point in the story of a people that is eternal, and that they have to make decisions that will impact a people whose story will extend for many thousands of years. They're making decisions in the moment, about the moment, and yet they have to think about how the decision they make will somehow impact a future so far beyond what will happen in the next decade. Julius Caesar is not thinking about Rome 2,000 years from when he's making that decision.
This is a very deep point. Caesar is thinking about the grandeur and majesty and expanse of Rome in terms of space and land and glory to himself and to the empire. But he's thinking, you could say, territorially and not historically.
Right. And even when you are the sort of statesman that thinks in terms of history, even let's say someone like Churchill, who definitely thinks in terms of history, the span of history just doesn't match up. One of my favorite stories is the story told by Yehuda Avner when he comes to England. He was from England, and he comes to England as Begin's ambassador to the court of St. James. And he gives his credentials to Queen Elizabeth, and Elizabeth says to him, you know, and she's probably met, I don't know, hundreds, maybe, you know, at that point, maybe thousands of ambassadors. And she says to him, you know, this is the first time that I've received the credentials of an ambassador from a foreign country who was born in this country. How did this happen? And Yehuda Avner says to the queen, Your Majesty, though I may have been born here in England, I was spiritually given birth to in Jerusalem, from where my ancestors were forcibly exiled by the Romans 2,000 years ago. And the queen says, were they really? How unfortunate. And she begins talking about the weather. That's what he writes. And he ends up reflecting, here I was reflecting on the conundrums of Jewish history. And there she was talking about the weather. Now, of course, what makes this story striking is that her whole job is to represent history. But how far back? She is, you know, a descendant, I guess, of the Hanoverian dynasty that was brought over to England a couple hundred years ago. And if you trace the British monarchy back to William the Conqueror, or you know, a little further back, what are we talking when compared to Jewish history? Which is, of course, why if you watch the coronation after Shabbat John of Charles III, if you immediately went online to watch it, as I assume you did after Shabbat, so much of the ceremony is drawn from references to David, because it's only the Davidic dynasty that offers an ancient biblical model. But for us, that's history. It's not just something that happened long ago. It's part of our story, a story that we believe has a continuation in Jerusalem today. And so you're operating on a totally different sphere of time. And that by definition will impact, at least if you're truly an excellent embodiment of a Jewish statesman, the decisions that you make in the moment, about the moment.
So I think the figure that most perfectly, most interestingly embodied this in your book is your analysis of Yochanan ben Zakkai. Why don't you explain to us, because if you think that David represents a kind of paradigm of rule, which combines both assertion and withdrawal, both asserting independent power and understanding that you are being acted upon and through. Yochanan ben Zakkai perhaps is most interesting for us in the way that he made judgments within the sweep of history and understanding his role and place in history.
Yes, exactly right. And as I note in the chapter, it's a particularly poignant example because some of the early Zionists did not give Yochanan ben Zakkai his due. And indeed, some may have even seen him as a villain in Jewish history. He, as an appeaser and one who wanted to engage in surrender. And so I make two points about him in the book.
Just for our listeners who don't know the story, tell us the story.
Yochanan ben Zakkai is famous for the action that he took described in the Talmud and the Midrash of fleeing besieged Jerusalem right before it fell to the Romans in order to set up an academy at Yavne and ensure the endurance of Judaism and set up a series of rituals and remembrances that simultaneously allowed Jews to mourn and mark the disaster that had occurred in Jerusalem while still binding themselves to Jerusalem and preserving the faith that Jews would return ultimately to Jerusalem. And as I noted in the book, rather than setting up, as the British historian Toynbee described it, a fossilized form of Judaism, what he actually did was ensure the flourishing of Judaism and was the one to whom so much of the credit for the ultimate Jewish return to Jerusalem ought to be accorded. I have a commentary piece on this called What Zionists Owe Yavne, something like that. I cite both in the book and in that article how Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, when the Knesset first met and Chaim Weizmann celebrated the great heroes of Zionism, to whom he said they owed this moment, Rabbi Soloveitchik noted with pain that no mention was made of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And so some secular Zionists saw him as someone because he fled Jerusalem and because he even counseled surrender, essentially, to the Romans. So he was seen by some as a villain. And I quote the great Zionist thinker who died tragically young, Yaakov Herzog, as to why this is such an incorrect understanding of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And what I also emphasize in the chapter is that Yochanan ben Zakkai counseled preparing for Jerusalem's destruction if surrender for the Romans would not happen, not because he believed that the revolution against Rome was unjust, but rather because he saw the internecine warfare in Jerusalem and believed that so long as Jews were willing to kill each other in Jerusalem, then Jerusalem would not deserve to be saved. And so the story of Yochanan ben Zakkai is a story of a man who makes decisions about the future of Judaism, decisions that were vindicated over a period of thousands of years. But nowadays, he speaks to us as well with the restoration of Jewish Jerusalem because of his understanding of how Jewish unity, of a metaphysic of Jewish unity, must lie in our understanding of Jewish Jerusalem and Jewish statehood. So he speaks to us profoundly today as much as he has over the last 2,000 years.
This gets to a question of prudence. If I can summarize, you know, the thought process or the deliberation that would have occurred that confronted Yochanan ben Zakkai, is a territorial retreat justified if the upshot of that territorial retreat is, number one, temporary, and number two, makes possible the inner essence of a nation which will perpetuate this people forward in history, maybe for thousands of years? How do you know how much retreat is merited? How do you know when to draw the line?
So the question has to be, what is your hierarchy of values? The great modern example that I give in the book is Menachem Begin's decision on the Altalena not to shoot back and to order his followers of the Irgun on the Altalena not to fire back. Now, we have to understand this is more than just about a conflict between former members of the Haganah and the Irgun. Begin was giving up on arms that were desperately needed by all of the newly born state of Israel. Arms that Begin believed could have saved ancient Jerusalem in 1948 for the Jewish state. And Begin says, if saving ancient Jerusalem and stopping the sinking of the Altalena means that Jews have to kill Jews and risk civil war right when the state of Israel is born, then we're not going to do it. Because we remember, and again, he describes things like this in the revolt. It shows how Jewish statesmanship operates in a totally different sphere of time. He's remembering the internecine warfare that Yochanan ben Zakkai was decrying. So he's in 1948 remembering internecine warfare in 69 CE, 70 CE, 68 CE. And he's saying, Mochemet Achim Liolam Lo, nevermore a war between brothers. And so he has a hierarchy of values. What he's engaging in is, to a certain extent, a retreat because he is giving up on badly needed arms. He's allowing Ben-Gurion to sink it to the bottom of the Mediterranean. But he's saying the metaphysic of Jewish unity and preventing bloodshed of Jews by the hands of Jews, that for him is a higher value. You ask a very important question of how do you know? And there's an amazing passage, John, in Rabbi Soloveitchik's speeches about Zionism, where he describes Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai on his deathbed crying. And the students say to him, why are you crying? And he says, because if there are two paths, one leading to heaven and one to hell, and I don't know where they're leading me, wouldn't you cry? Now, this is one of the great rabbinic leaders. He's worried about going to hell. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says, yeah, because he is terrified that maybe he made the wrong decision. And we believe he made the right decision. And at his last moment, he says, when he's dying, he says, I see Hezekiah, king of Judah, who is coming to greet me. And the point, and this is a point made in different ways by both the Agadah scholar Yonah Frankel and by Yaakov Herzog, is that this is meant to be a vindication of Yochanan ben Zakkai. In other words, Hezekiah was the leader that saved Jerusalem from Assyria, but saved at the hands of God. And here Yochanan ben Zakkai could seemingly be accused as the man who gave up on Jerusalem. And by the savior of Jerusalem coming to escort Yochanan ben Zakkai into the next world, it's a way of saying that you too are actually a savior of Jerusalem. By operating not only in the here and now, but by operating on a span of time far beyond that, you have ensured the future of Jewish Jerusalem. And indeed, he is so remembered today.
So we have to understand that in this conception, the presence of Jews in Jerusalem, say, let's expand that, Zionism itself, the way that we understand the Jewish return to the land of Israel and its sovereignty there, in this conception is made possible by the promulgation of Rabbinic Judaism at the hands of political defeat.
Yes. Michael Wishegrad said that, and he notes this in The Body of Faith, his book, The Body of Faith. He says that one might have expected one of two different responses from Rabbinic Judaism after the destruction of the temple, neither of which happened. He said, you might have thought that maybe they would have said, sacrifices are not necessary to Judaism and the temple is not necessary. Or you might have thought they might have said, we can rebuild the temple elsewhere and continue the rites of Leviticus elsewhere. And they said neither. They said this, of course, because it's true. They said, actually, Jerusalem is the permanent dwelling place of the divine. And actually, Judaism without Jerusalem and without the temple is a shadow of its former self. And the only way forward is forward while remembering Jerusalem, cultivating a love of it, ensuring that Jews pray toward it wherever they are around the world. And of course, in so doing, that is what preserved Jewish peoplehood and Jewish identity and ensure the return to Jerusalem. The phrase that Wishegrad gives us, which is a striking phrase, he says something like, the secret is Jewish history's ability to recognize defeat. In recognizing defeat, they actually ensured return and ultimate victory. That's a counterintuitive, profound truth at the heart of Yochanan ben Zakkai's leadership and at the heart of Jewish history itself.
You know, I can't resist, but we're having this conversation soon after a communal remembrance of one of those signaled defeats. And the strategy of remembering those defeats and reliving them is actually one of the ingenious secrets to Jewish perpetuity. In the very fact of commemorating and reliving them, we ensure that we remain together and see a way to redeem that defeat in the future. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I want to move ahead because we've now said that there are, we've identified two deep strains in the conception of Jewish statesmanship. Number one, this ambiguity between assertion and humility, power and providence. Number two, we've talked about the timeline and the sense of history within which Jewish statesmanship operates. We now have to just say plainly something we might have said earlier, which is, what are you kidding me? Why statesmanship? There's not a state here. All these statesmen are acting on behalf of some kind of entity that does not have sovereignty, that doesn't have borders. Yochanan Zakkai is acting on behalf of what exactly? And some of the later figures that you mentioned, that you analyze, Abravanel, some of the rabbinic figures later. How can there be such a thing as statecraft when there's no state?
So what is statesmanship? Statesmanship, of course, is engaging those in power on behalf of one's people. One can be oneself in a position of power, or one can, with wisdom, be engaging the realm of power and of politics on behalf of one's people. And of course, the striking story of Jewish history is that this is the tale of a people that never stopped being a people, despite losing its power. And at some of its most important moments, had leaders that engaged in statesmanship, in the affairs of state, on behalf of one's people. Now, of course, in the modern era, this was actually Herzl's genius. Herzl says, look, if the Jewish people want to return, and if we want to highlight that we are a people, we need to engage in statesmanship. We need to put together a political organization, and we need to just walk into the courts of political leaders on behalf of a people. That's what Herzl did. And of course, that's something that historians have recognized. What I want to point out in the book is that others did it before him. Menashe ben Israel did it in the court of the Lord and Protector of England. It's in a strange way, not actually strange, it's more just a counter to the usual narrative. My guess is that there would have been some early Zionists that would have thought that Jewish law, Jewish ritual, and tradition were relics of exile, and Jewish politics is born in Zionism and Jewish return. But actually, John, a lot of our minhagim, not the actual law, but so much of our non-expressly legal traditions that we have today, were born in Eretz Yisrael a couple hundred years ago in the Kabbalistic circles of Tzfat. Rituals like Kabbalat Shabbat or Simchat Torah are born in the north of Israel. Whereas actually, if you look at the stories of Abarbanel, especially in the stories of Sephardic Judaism in the pre-modern era, Abarbanel and Menashe ben Israel, you see in the diaspora Jewish leaders that come into the courts of kings and other political leaders on behalf of people and engage in political discussion and pleading and negotiation and diplomacy. And at times they fail in their aims. That's the haunting aspect of the story of Abarbanel. And at times, at least in the way I argue for it, they succeed beyond what they think they've achieved, as in the case of Menashe ben Israel. But models do exist before Herzl, and that's part of what I'm trying to contribute with my book.
Here's one of these paradoxes again. When you're thinking about a negotiation with princes on behalf of your people, so I mean, maybe the easiest modern, most famous modern example of this would be the Reagan Doctrine or other such doctrines, which rely on the idea that if you have the threat of a credible military force, it makes it likelier that you'll achieve diplomatic success, because peace through strength means that the very possibility of unleashing some kind of military action means you're taken more seriously at the negotiating table. That's a way that statesmen have of thinking about the leverage that they hold, and threats could be one of the sources of leverage, but the leverage that they hold when negotiating with political leaders. So here comes Menashe ben Israel. Here comes Abravanel. What cards do they hold when they're negotiating with princes?
So let me give you a modern example of someone who is engaging in statesmanship without the leverage of military threat, but is surely one of the great examples of statesmanship in our time. A band of colonists decide that they don't want to be part of the British Empire anymore, and they declare independence. Now they're in revolution against one of the mightiest empires on earth. Benjamin Franklin comes to Paris. Now he's meeting with French officials. He's engaging in diplomacy in the court of the French king. He's not there leveraging his military power against France, obviously. What is he doing? He's saying, the enemy of your enemy should be your friend. You want to see shame come to the British. We're trying to defeat the British. And if a ragtag bunch of colonists can overthrow the British Empire, that would be pretty shameful for Britain. You want to see that shame happen? Join us. So he's thinking about leveraging what he can leverage to achieve the well-being of his newly born nation, which is, of course, what John Adams is trying to do in a different way when he's trying to get loans from the Netherlands. But in neither case are they using military leverage in the courts in which they find themselves or in the political spheres in which they find themselves.
This is a hard-headed appeal to the interests of the other nations.
Yes, it's still statesmanship at the highest level. No one would deny it. To this day, we recognize what Franklin did as one of the most important acts of statesmanship in the history of the American Revolution. As important as Washington and Yorktown, or rather, Washington and Yorktown wouldn't have happened if not for what Franklin did. And so with Menashe ben Israel, you have an act of statesmanship, which in a certain sense is similar, but made all the more remarkable by the fact that he's dealing simultaneously in the realms of politics and faith. Because, of course, Cromwell is engaging both simultaneously in the realms of politics and faith, because the revolution against the Stuarts in England was very much about religion as much as it was about politics. And so Menashe ben Israel, after having built up a reputation as this intellectual rabbi who engages the larger Christian world, now suddenly, in the most unlikely way, comes to an England that expelled the Jews in 1290 and is engaging Cromwell, asking for not just Jewish admission, but Jewish rights. And at the same time, debating the anti-Semites that are in England that are very much part of the politics of England as well. So in a certain sense, it's different, but it's not that different from what I'm describing with Franklin. And it highlights how you don't have to embody military leverage to engage in statesmanship at the highest level. And that, of course, is what makes Menashe ben Israel so remarkable. All the more remarkable because no one asked him to do it.
I just mean that tools that statesmen who represent nations have include carrots and sticks.
Absolutely right. And so he comes to Cromwell and he makes a quasi-religious argument, building, I think, on Cromwell's own interest in what the Jewish people mean for history. And he's basically saying, if you let us in, we will be a blessing to your England. And Cromwell's open to this. Now, in a strange and, or at least counterintuitive and I think providential way, he only seems to partially succeed Menashe ben Israel. Cromwell lets the Jews have a presence, but not an official equal presence. But providentially, as I cite from historians like Jane Gerber, that ends up working out better for the Jews, because then when the Stuarts come back, it's not seen as a singular act of Cromwell. So the Jews are allowed to stay. And there's a line to be drawn from Menashe ben Israel's statesmanship to the statesmanship that brings about the Balfour Declaration. So there's both power and providence here. But the carrot here, rather than the stick, is all the more intriguing, because it's not the carrot of making England look bad, as it was for France in the American Revolution. It's the carrot of faith. But faith can, of course, motivate. Religion can motivate for good and for ill in acts of statesmanship. Certainly, no one would say that in the terrible decree expelling Jews from Spain, religion wasn't at the heart of it. Religion was very much at the heart of it. Religion is bound up with acts of state and power throughout the history of the world.
The example of Herzl that you find to echo dimensions of Abravanel and Menashe ben Israel also puts me in mind of another thing that Jewish statesmen and all statesmen have to attend to, which is we tend to look at their accomplishments or their endeavors as they relate to other leaders in the realm of diplomacy, in the realm of politics. But of course, they also have got to have some kind of popular support. They also have to be in touch with the people that they lead. And crucially, the other leaders have to see them representing those people. Now, here you have, in the case of Herzl, for example, nobody elected Herzl. The millions of Jews in Europe, they didn't come, there was no form, political form, for them to come together and say, this is the person that we want representing us in front of the Kaiser, in front of the Sultan, in front of Baron de Rothschild. Nobody said that. So Herzl had this amazing way of standing before those political leaders and asserting, simply asserting, that he was this popularly supported leader, and then taking that meeting back to the people and saying, I'm negotiating on your behalf with all these political leaders. And the very fact that he had those meetings and was engaged in that kind of political activity gave him some cachet, additional cachet among the people.
What you're saying is absolutely correct. And yet there's one other aspect to it that makes the story of Herzl so striking, which is that you're absolutely right that the drama to his political persona inspired this great response from the Jewish masses. But unlike, say, Churchill, who inspires in the way that he seeks to inspire, the drama of Herzl is that the reaction that Herzl gets is not quite what he was seeking, but actually something much greater. And in the book, I cite the description of Yaakov Herzog, who captures this. And the way he puts it is as follows, writing about Herzl, he writes, "He spoke and wrote of the Jewish people attaining a normal status among the nations of the world. But for the masses who were gripped by his message and acknowledged his leadership, the goal was not normalcy, it was redemption. That indefinable feeling and urge that remained inviolate in their innermost souls down the ages." And then he adds that Herzl spoke, quote, "in terms of conventional political parlance. They answered him in terms of immortal prophecy, undying faith, and historic destiny." That's what Herzog writes. That's exactly right. So the drama of Herzl is that he starts the politics, but the response, he sparks something that's much greater than he even understood. And that's, again, the story of power and providence. That there are moments where, as John Page wrote to Thomas Jefferson, when he suddenly wrote sort of with awe, "Can you not see that there is an angel in the whirlwind that directs this storm?" And there's moments in reading Herzl's story that you can't help but feeling that. And that I think he may have been awed also at certain moments to realize, because it was far beyond, in a certain sense, what he was trying to do.
Herzl represents another thematic in the book, perhaps more clearly than anyone else, but it's present in virtually every one of them too, which is, although many of these people are operating on behalf of a people who do not have a state, they nevertheless are yearning, dreaming, longing for a state, for a return of political sovereignty. And that's one of the essential characteristics of Jewish statesmanship, in your view.
Yes, and it comes from a certain sense of the drama of Jewish history itself. Even Disraeli, who you might think, in a certain sense, and in a certain sense, is the quote-unquote least Jewish person in this book, at the same time, was someone with such a profound sense of the drama of Jewish history that his awe at the Jewish past gave him faith in the Jewish future. So in his novel Tancred, describing Sukkot, an observance of Sukkot in London, and describing anti-Semites in London sneering at Jews having a harvest hut, remembering the harvest of the land of Israel, while in, you know, the slums of the city of London, he writes something like, "A people that refuses to forget the vintage of their land is destined to regain that vintage." And so in a certain sense, the one person who you think should be the least focused on the Holy Land is actually incredibly focused on the land, writes a novel about the Holy Land, and his deep sense of the Jewish past drives, inspires his faith in the Jewish future. And that is, of course, at the heart of Jewish leadership itself. Just as Abarbanel has a deep faith at the very moment, Abarbanel, who, as Benzion Netanyahu wrote, understood himself to be a descendant of King David, at the moment when everything fails, when he realizes that expulsion is happening, he proudly turns down the offer of power and wealth if he converts, and basically informs the most powerful monarchs on earth that the empires that curse the Jewish people will ultimately disappear from history. And he has this deep faith in the Jewish future that is driven by his profound understanding as a leader, as a rabbi, and as a biblical scholar of the miracle of the Jewish past.
The Jewish past is obviously, one simply cannot read the memoirs, the speeches, biographies of David Ben-Gurion without seeing how profoundly inspired all of his great accomplishments were by his immersion in the Jewish past. And here we have some of the enduring themes of Jewish statesmanship link up with that explosion of Zionist activity during those years. You are famously a partisan of Ben-Gurion's great political rival, Menachem Begin. Tell us what it was like for you to try to understand what can be learned from Ben-Gurion's accomplishment here.
It's undeniable that Ben-Gurion is the great figure of 1948. And what drives him, as I argue in the book, is Ahavat Eretz Yisrael. He has a deep love of the land of Israel. On his grave, it makes no mention of him being prime minister of Israel or the person who read Israel's Declaration of Independence. It just lists the date, aside from, I think, birth and death, it lists the date that he made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. And he has a deep sense of the biblical story of what the Jews, of what Am Yisrael did in Eretz Yisrael. And that's what drives him, his deep connection to what occurred in the land thousands of years before. That lives for him. What doesn't live for him with as much resonance is all that Yochanan ben Zakkai brought about. The Jewish life in the thousands of years of Galut while remembering Eretz Yisrael, the almost 2,000 years. That doesn't live as strongly. So he's deeply driven by this connection to Eretz Yisrael, and that is the source of his strength when he has to make some incredibly important decisions in the years surrounding Israel's founding and the creation of the state. I chose to conclude the book by contrasting Ben-Gurion and Begin. I do not argue in the book that Menachem Begin is the most important figure in the birth of modern Israel. And I don't think anyone writing history can make that claim. I do see providence in the fact that the major decisions that Ben-Gurion made, ensuring Israel's birth and endurance, ended up creating a state whose civic culture today is closer to Menachem Begin's version of Zion than David Ben-Gurion's version of Zion.
More religious, more culturally Jewish.
More culturally Jewish, but also one whose culture deeply reflects the union of cultures that was Menachem Begin's political coalition. Today, Israeli politicians, the day after Pesach, go around and mark a mimuna, the Moroccan Jewish post-Pesach celebration. That's you know.
That's not David Ben-Gurion's Israel, yeah.
You and I are both big fans of Yishai Ribo, who marks the bridging of all sorts of different realms of modern Israel. His music bridges Sephardim and Ashkenazim, secular and religious. It draws deeply on biblical texts that Ben-Gurion would have loved, but it draws deeply on rabbinic liturgical texts that were at the heart of the Judaism that Menachem Begin never forgot. And we can discuss, not for this podcast, but to what extent some of the current political debates taking place in Israel are reflections of the Mahapach, the upheaval that began in Israeli politics with the election of Menachem Begin in 1977. With history, you can look back and see the seeds being laid for that in Israel's future. But just as I believe, well, let's put it this way, if Daniel Webster saw in the passing of Jefferson and Adams on July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day of the Declaration, as a sign of God's providence, a sign of the providence in which Jefferson maybe didn't believe that strongly, we can see in David Ben-Gurion's own remarkable achievements a sign of the providence in which maybe Ben-Gurion himself didn't believe in all that strongly. The final words of my chapter on Begin and Ben-Gurion says precisely that. The way I put it is that one can perhaps see in the singular definitive role played by David Ben-Gurion, who emerged with all of his flaws to shepherd the birth of the Jewish state and profoundly influence its flourishing, evidence for the God whose providential purposes Ben-Gurion himself doubted and in whose existence Menachem Begin ardently believed. And so, as strange as Ben-Gurion might have found this, I try to present a Begin-esque appreciation of David Ben-Gurion's achievements.
You've mentioned already in our conversation Winston Churchill, perhaps the greatest statesman of the 20th century. When asked, I think near the end of his life, how statesmen can be educated, he replied, study history, for in history lies all the secrets of statecraft. Is that the message that you'd have to young Jewish women and men who aspire to some of the figures in your book?
100%. With the caveat that as Chaim Yosef Yerushalmi and Rabbi Jonathan Sacks have noted, Jews tend to speak of memory rather than history. And what that means is that for us, the people whose history we study are living figures. I begin my foreword to the book and note it in conclusion. The famous phrase from the Talmud, David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam, King David lives and endures, which means that for us, a king who lived thousands of years ago, his presence is everywhere when you walk in Jerusalem today. He's a living figure. Churchill may have thought that way sometimes, but for Jews, this is just natural. There's an apocryphal quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik. It may be something he actually said. It sounds like something he would have said, that he was approached for reflections on the 800th anniversary of the passing of Maimonides. And he said, "This is the first time I am hearing that Maimonides is not alive." Because for us, these figures live. And just as Rabbi Soloveitchik described very famously and movingly how when he gives shir, when he gives a lecture in Talmud, these figures are alive and in his class. For the student of Jewish history, and ideally for the statesman acting within Jewish history, you feel these figures at your side. I have no doubt in my mind that when Menachem Begin is at Camp David being pressured to give up on aspects of Jewish sovereignty over Jerusalem, and he is refusing, he feels King David by his side. And this is also an element of Jewish memory, he feels the Jewish masses at his side. Begin wrote at the end of the revolt an amazing passage. The reason why he talks in his memoir, not just about leaders, but also some of the soldiers of the revolt, like Tov Gruner, who was hung by the British. Begin writes, in history, there is a great deal of injustice. And what he meant by that is that we only remember the leaders, and that truly great Jewish leaders have to be motivated not just by the memory of leaders, but by the hope, memory, and the feeling of communion with the hopes and dreams of the Jewish masses throughout generations. And so Yochanan ben Zakkai is both embodying and cultivating the hopes and dreams of the Jewish masses. Sadducee Jews had a rival faction to Yochanan ben Zakkai in the temple. They were the elite in Jewish Jerusalem. They were the wealthy elite. Their version of Jewish life had no future. Yochanan ben Zakkai's Judaism, of course, which as a rabbinic Jew, I believe is not just enduring, but is the true version of Judaism, endured. But it endured in the hopes and dreams of the masses. In the end, as Yaakov Herzog said, Herzl's great achievements were linked to the response he got because of the yearnings and dreams of the Jewish masses. And so we have to study history, but the way Jews study history is slightly different than the way others study history. We don't study it as a removal. It is for us, ideally, an all-embracing, an emotional act of communion.
Providence and Power, 10 Portraits in Jewish Statesmanship was published by Encounter in 2023. Rabbi Soloveitchik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, John.